As we talk, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air, Jimmy Merritt.
It's a pleasure.
Great to meet you. I'd love to talk a little bit about your career and learning to play your instrument and then finding out what you're doing now and who's in your band. But let's start with how you started to play jazz. Did you listen to a lot of jazz when you were growing up? You know, like when I was growing up, you had to really look hard to find jazz on the radio. It was easier to find middle-of-the-road music and rock and roll. What did you listen to when you were young?
I grew up on it from infancy. One of the first phonographs in the neighborhood was owned by my aunt. And at that time, they gave away record collections when you bought a phonograph. So the first people I heard were Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong. And later on, Jimmy Lunsford and Lester Young and Count Basie. And these became standards. These were the people we heard all the time. If we didn't hear them, we heard somebody in the local tap room trying to play like them. You know, so it was that kind of experience.
What attracted you to the bass?
Well, that was kind of an accident, really, because I started out playing saxophone and clarinet because my idol was Lester Young, still is. When I went into service, I contracted a sinus condition. And when I came out, it gave me so much trouble. I was really frustrated at my wit's end about how I was going to go. And although I had studied piano as a child, I really didn't feel that I could that I wanted to deal with piano other than for my own amusement. So my mother one day came home and she said, "Would you help me out of the cab? I've got something here." And she had this bass in the cab with us. She and my uncle had somehow gotten together and got this bass and just put it in the cab and brought it home. And from there, I never looked back.
Did you start taking lessons right away or did you just play
around? I just started playing. And later, I guess about a year later, I decided I was going to study just to see how well I could do at it. And I went down to the Philadelphia Conservatory. And they gave me a test, which was somewhat rigorous, and I was surprised because I passed. And from then on, I studied until I was satisfied that, not that I knew enough, but that I knew enough to go into my main interest.
You had spent some time studying with, I think it was Carl Turello.
Carl Turello.
From the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Yes.
Did he try to convince you to unlearn habits that you'd picked up before you started studying more formally?
No, he didn't, because I had a sort of a look about things that were systematic, and I had learned to play the instrument pretty well as far as what was. In fact, he was rather surprised, and he encouraged me. He encouraged me to continue, and he encouraged me to continue in jazz, although that wasn't his idiom.
What was the jazz scene like in Philadelphia when you were starting to play? Who were the other musicians around, and were there different musicians' cliques
that
had formed?
No, it was very warm. It was very warm. I remember being asked almost when I initially, before I'd been playing a year to play, I was playing with Hassan Ibn Ali, who passed recently, and as far as I'm concerned, is one of the geniuses of our times. And at the time, it was just the two of us, a duo. We played together for about a year, and that was an amazing experience for me just starting out. And the players were very, very warm about letting you play. And if you played wrong notes or, you know, you were short on this or that, everybody just sort of accepted it. And I guess I inculcated this to my own attitude because I've been very, if I see a player as in earnest, I don't usually demand. I just wait because I know it'll come if he's real.
You mentioned Hassan Ibn Ali, and he I think only made like one record,
yes,
or something.
That's right.
I had heard rumors before he died a few years ago that he was basically living on the streets and didn't have any money or had gone a little crazy. What was the story? Were you still in touch with him before he died?
Well, I was about up until the time that I felt that there was nothing that I could do, and I've had to come to this conclusion quite a few times in my life because frequently people of talent are greatly distraught about the way things are happening. And it's very difficult a lot of them, times for them to reconcile themselves to things. And so you just, it's a sort of a fatalistic attitude. You accept the fact that they're going to do with their lives what they have to. And you're going to be prepared for whatever the outcome is. And for those of us who understand, it's never like making less of a person of them because of how they choose to live out the remainder of their life. I think, if anything, it's a commentary on what we have to grow into our society.
So what's that point for you when you decide to kind of withdraw? Because it's kind of a reflex to try to help someone and do what you can for them, and then maybe you get to the point that you were describing where you realize that you cannot change the direction of mm-hmm. the person's life. When do you realize it's at that point with Hassan or with anyone else who that's happened with?
Well, I guess it's a question of your own circumstances. Each person has his limit. I guess that depends on irrespective. And people go some more times than others, but each person has a limit as far as what they can do for the next person before it begins to affect them. And so it's this kind of decision is being made all along the line, because you're seeing people who are talented every day. I'm going through the same problem, not problem, but situation as regards other people I know, but it's something because, and this is one thing about going in the church, and this is why I'm recommending, in a sense, looking for a spiritual outlook, because I feel if the player goes to a place of where he can renew himself, when he comes out, chances are he have a better understanding of himself, and that'll help him to be able to relate to things in a way that'll...
Mm-hmm. Let me reintroduce you. For our listeners just joining us, I'm with bass player Jimmy Merritt, who's now leading his own band. He's based in Philadelphia, and the band will be performing this Sunday at Penn's Landing as part of the opening concert in the Cool Jazz Festival. Well, you were telling us a little bit about what the scene was like in Philadelphia when you started to play. You spent a few years with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers.
Yeah.
How did you hook up with Blakey's band?
Well, I spent about 5 years with Art, and it happened just on a lark. I went over to New York one day just on a holiday, and he jumped off the bandstand and ran down and asked me, did I want to join the band? I didn't even know, that he knew me personally. And in fact, at that time, I was performing basically as a rock and roll entertainer. I was still steeped in the tradition. I had studied it all my life, but for practicality, I was. And also for the challenge, I wanted to see. I had heard this rumor about entertainers carrying musicians. So I decided to find out, well, if a musician could be an entertainer. And so I worked at that for a while, and I enjoyed it. But it was only a phase. So I welcomed the opportunity. And at the time, I didn't even have an instrument, because I'd already switched over to electric bass as early on as mid-40s, I guess. But early 50s. I got an instrument, and then I guess a couple of weeks later, they sent me some tapes of what the band was doing. I just went in and started playing. That was about, and never stopped.
What's the distinction between an entertainer and a musician?
I think the objectives. I think, well, an entertainer, to be good, has to be concerned with what the word says. But a person who's going to be involved in an art form has to, there's a certain dedication that they have to, a posture they have to assume in regard to the demands of the form itself.
When you were playing with Blakey, what kind of musical relationship did your bass have to his drums? He's certainly one of the most influential and dynamic mm-hmm. musicians in all of jazz, and a very, very active drummer. He does a lot more than just keep the time. So as part of that rhythm section, what kind of interplay do you feel you had with him?
Well, it was a great, it was like instant magic. It was a great thing, and I still enjoy any time I get a chance to play with him or people like him, because it was just instant. I could say that I was prepared for it. It wasn't like a learning experience for me like it has been, fortunately, for a lot of players that have gone with him, because I had steeped myself well, and I had been trained by people who were very, very good at that, like Charlie Rice right here in Philadelphia. And I had played with Ray Zagar and Philly Joe on occasion, people like that, all along. So it was a good chance to put some of these things it was just a great experience. And I guess going with Max was the same way. Although there's a great difference in the
yeah. What's the difference?
Well, it's a basic a philosophy. The philosophy. I always thought that was the most important thing about a great jazz player was his thoughts. And they both have very distinctive thoughts about how they proceed. With art, time is like tone is to some classical musicians. And if you don't recognize that time, well, he'll come down, you know, because it is important to the idiom. It's very important. Even if a player is going to play abstract, even if there's not going to be any time, the sense of time has to be there. And with Max, it's about the individual. Each person has to be able to stand himself. And this is another lesson, whereas with artists, it's a collective experience. So you have both things working for you as far as... they're both very valuable.
Was either more attuned to your perceptions of music?
What is it?
Was either of those philosophies more attuned to your philosophy of music?
Well, I found them both were equally valid, because I'm interested in the whole jazz experience, and you do have to develop your own individuality, and you do have to have a sense of collective involvement, and sharing, and doing creating things together.
I'd like to play another record that you're featured on with Art Blakey, who we've been discussing. We can hear a Benny Golson piece called Are You Real? I imagine this is also a Benny Golson arrangement.
It's a Benny Golson arrangement.
And this is from an Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers album called Monin. And we can hear Lee Morgan on trumpet, Benny Golson, the composer on tenor, Bobby Timmons at the piano, Art Blakey, of course, on drums, and my guest Jimmy Merritt on bass. Would you like to see how much you remember about this session? Could you tell us what you remember about it?
Well, I remember the personnel and the message in the tune itself, which I think is a great one, and the straightforwardness of it, you know, the way it's done and the way it was received, and when we did it, it was really a great, great feeling.
Had you rehearsed this a lot?
Like I was saying, I never rehearsed with the band. They sent me some tapes of what they were doing, and I listened to them while I was finishing out my tenure as a rock musician. And I just went in and played. And it was like that the whole experience. I always was looking forward to rehearsing. We never did really get into it. It was just studying the composer's work and then just going ahead and playing it.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is Benny Golson's Are You Real? Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, and my guest Jimmy Merritt on bass.
Thank you.
Benny Golson's Are You Real, as recorded by Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. And Jimmy Merritt says he remembers the session being in October of 1958. And we heard Lee Morgan on trumpet, Benny Golson on tenor, Bobby Timmons at the piano, Art Blakey on drums, and of course Jimmy Merritt on bass. And I want to mention again that if you'd like to hear the band that he's leading now, they will be playing Sunday at the opening concert of the Cool Jazz Festival. This will be a free concert at Penn's Landing. The concert will go on from 2 until 6, and Jimmy Merritt's band is expected to play from 3 until 4 o'clock. A few years after you played with the Blakey Band, you played with Lee Morgan, after playing with him in the Blakey Band. I guess everybody must have been really shaken up at his death.
Well, like I was saying earlier, I wasn't exactly shaken up because I've learned to accept those things, but I was, it did reinforce a lot of things, and it did start me to look at things a lot more, not seriously, but to look at the fact that we have a limited amount of time on this earth, and that we're more or less here for some reason, and if we can make up our minds of what that reason is, that's what we should be concerned about.
What was it about his death that made you think that?
Well, we had been talking minutes before he died. We had been talking about the future of the band, and we were talking very personally, just he and I, about what the future of the band, what we'd hoped, you know, to do, and he was very elated about it. And it looked like he was realizing himself at that point, and I guess it was just a matter of the past, a certain abruptness in artists a lot of times that people don't understand. Sometimes they don't understand themselves, which is one reason I still go back to the point about the spirituality as being a factor that might, if one gets a chance to have a little more serenity in one's life.
But did you consciously decide at that point to not tour and record as much?
I think I did without realizing it, because I went home sort of packed up, and that was sort of it. As far as, I didn't turn my back on music, but I began to take a very long look at how things are done, you know.
Could you tell us a little bit about how you've spent the last 10 years?
Well, mostly on the research on the music I've been doing, trying to look deeper into the thought processes of the what we call the forerunners. That is the jazz musicians who came before us, those who spent their lives in idiom, and to try to decipher and understand what they were really about. And then try to reconstruct, not from a sound, but from a thought basis.
How do you do that, through thinking or listening, playing?
Reconstructing in terms of the thinking, the philosophical basis behind a particular thing, and how that could apply in another situation. And that way we don't have to be play the same music, but we can arrive at the same feeling.
You've done a lot of freelancing with many different musicians, so you've had to be a bass player in lots of different settings. Do you think of the bass as being like the timekeeper? What do you think of the role of the bass in a small band?
No, I think things are evolutionary. I think at the time that we were playing, like in 58, for instance, there was a necessity to make that kind of a statement about time because of the state that the art was at that time. And the need to direct attention to maybe just time itself. But as a player's time becomes more developed, I don't think he needs to be that explicit about it. The time can be implied, and it can be equally effective.
I know some musicians feel that they have to keep current, you know, like for a singer, mm-hmm. that might mean learning the latest tunes on the radio so that, you know, if you're playing in a club and someone makes a request, mm-hmm. that you'll know it. As a bass player who has done a lot of freelancing, is there any equivalent of that you have to do to, quote, keep current?
to keep current?
Yeah, I don't know. Like some people figure, well, I'd better pick up an electric bass just in case I get a gig with one electric bass player, because that's what a lot of musicians want now. Does that not matter?
To the artist aspirant, I think it's a little different maybe as regards if you want to be an entertainer. He has to learn these things also, but as a means to an end, not as the end in itself. So as far as his training is concerned, he learns these things at different stages of his development, but then at certain stages, I don't think he has to continue. I think, in fact, it could be a form of social intimidation if he continues over a certain period. At a certain point, he should know what he's about.
Is that hard to do, because it's sometimes hard to make enough money to keep things going and do what you believe in at the same time?
No, there are musicians today are finding alternative solutions.
Like what?
Well, some of them are doing other things. Like some people may brag, some musicians may brag about the fact that they never did anything but play music. But then if you were maybe to consider the quality of music that they had to play over the entire period of their life, there might be some reason for concern there. Maybe it would be better to, at times when the quality of music dropped for whatever reasons, to simply do something else.
Have you ever had other jobs besides music?
Oh, sure.
What kind of things have you done?
Well, I worked in the Census Bureau and got a fact of citation from the Census Department. I've worked in my father's business, which is real estate. And I admire him greatly. And that's the main reason, because I'm really not about real estate, but I enjoy working with him. And I enjoy working with people that use their hands. I might just go out and get a job doing anything if I didn't feel like playing.
Are there times when you don't feel like playing?
Well, performing, but not playing as such, no.
So there's times you
don't. But you were talking about making a living. So.
Right, right. So even if you're not doing a lot of performing, you'd still be doing a lot of playing, but not on stage.
Uh-huh.
So do you do things like practice anymore, or is it just playing when you pick up the bass?
Well, it's both, because there's a lot of practicing. This may be a different form of practicing as regards jazz, as far as I'm concerned, than maybe as far as other types of music. Because there's certain things I feel you have to become second nature. So there's a certain things that you do have to continually exercise so that they do become second nature.
My impressions have always been that when you're a musician, there's always that risk that if you don't keep playing, that you'll lose something, you know, like your fingers will forget a little bit, or you'll lose your speed, or just lose the ability to get beneath your fingers exactly what it is you're hearing. Is that true?
Well, it might be. It might be true if what you're doing is based but if it's based on what you think, then the chances are it won't evade you, because your mind will be ahead of your fingers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to hear a little bit about the band that you're leading now, but before we talk about that, let's listen to another session that you're featured on, and this is from a Chet Baker album called The Most Important Jazz Album of 1964-65. That's the title. And we're going to be hearing a piece that Tad Dameron wrote, and it's also his arrangement. The piece is Mating Call. Would you like to say a little bit about Tad Dameron's arrangements? You've played a few of them.
Are
they very special to you?
I think he was a great musician and a great force in the music for those who were fortunate enough to be around him. Certainly to Benny Golson, and I hear now that Philly Joe is performing his works, and I think that's the greatest thing that could happen, that somebody could.
Do you ever play his music in your band at all?
Well, no, like I said, our band was not such on the lines of a recreative experience. We will seek other means and to recreate the works of the players that come before us.
Okay, well, let's hear this recording of Mating Call, and it features Chet Baker on flugelhorn, with Phil Urso on tenor, Al Galper at the piano, Charlie Rice, who Jimmy Merritt mentioned a little earlier, on drums, and of course Jimmy Merritt on bass. Quoted in 1965, that was Chet Baker on trumpet. My guest Jimmy Merritt featured on bass. The piece we heard was Mating Call, written and arranged by Tad Dameron. And Jimmy Merritt's band will be performing this Sunday at the opening concert of the Cool Jazz Festival. The concert starts at 2 and runs till 6, and Jimmy Merritt's band is expected to play the set from 3 until 4 o'clock. You're from Philadelphia and continue to live here. You've traveled all the way around the world, I guess, during the time that you've been based in Philadelphia. Why have you decided to live here? I know a lot of musicians feel that they need to be either in Los Angeles, where there's session jobs, or in New York, where there's a lot of clubs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I lived in New York for a while, and I like to say, as far as New York is concerned, I do think it is the mecca for jazz players. I think all jazz players should go there at some point in their life. And it has something to offer that still no other place has. I've lived briefly in Los Angeles, London, Paris, but New York is unique. There's something, it's because of the number of dedicated people that come there to play jazz, some of whom you never hear of outside of New York. And it's a pleasure to get in a situation and play just for the sheer joy of playing, where players sometimes play 2 and 3 hours straight. And that's the kind of thing that we're currently trying to do here, because it's an experience you can't forget.
Do you feel that there are advantages for you now living in Philadelphia?
Not so to speak. If anything, disadvantages. But I think I believe in roots, and I feel, although I'm not actively involved with my family, we live a little far apart. I live in North Philadelphia, they live in Chester, the rest of my family is in West Philadelphia. But because I recently married, I live in North Philadelphia. I married a very lovely person, and that's one reason I'm glad I came back to Philadelphia. And I just think that unless a person has a better reason, they should make contact wherever their roots are, and because it should happen anywhere, and it can.
Tell us a little bit about the band you're leading now.
Well, I'm very enthused because it's a great bunch of young fellas. I say young. The youngest one is in his late 20s, and they've all graduated music school. They've paid their dues, put in a certain amount of experience in different working bands, and now most of them are in Philadelphia, and they're looking for some deeper experience. So we're going to the Church of the Messiah up at Broad and Roosevelt Boulevard every Sunday afternoon. And it's going to be like, as far as we're concerned, a spiritual experience. They come from all backgrounds. Some of them are Christian, some of them are Muslim, some of them are Buddhist, some of them are independent thinkers. But there's one thing they all have in common. They're all very spiritual people. So they're looking for higher forms of ways to solve problems. And that's what it's about, you know. So we get together every week, and it's a rigorous workout, and everybody has other obligations. But somehow, they get there. The drummer comes all the way from New Jersey. He has a family. He has 3 children. Sometimes he has to babysit, but he manages to get there. He brings his whole drums over. He sets up, and we play half of the night. Gomar Duncan, who's we've had a relationship with him for about 20 years, which has been mostly off the bandstand. Most of the time, for one reason or other, he's working with somebody else, I'm somewhere else. But we come together, and we experience something together musically that we aren't able to find, I guess, in a lot of a working situation. And now we have 4 horns. We have Bobby Zanko working with us, who's with Siambre, and outside of Alan Nelson, who's with Rufus Harley, and Robert Shabazz, who's been working with Art Blakey Jr. in New York, and Melvin Vines, who's studied with Nathan Davis at the University of Pittsburgh. He's in the city now and on trumpet, and Julian Presley. He's just back from working with the Stylistics, which was a good experience for him on the road. And so everybody's real enthused about what we're doing.
Okay.
Well, Dennis Henderson was the most recent to join. He's a percussionist, Afro-percussionist. He studied with the master percussionist, Bobby Crowder. He's worked with people like Ornette Coleman. And so we're really looking forward to the experience of getting together and coming up with some new forms.
Well, good luck with the band, and